From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. Another Supreme Court term has come to a close. This year, the court delivered major decisions on reproductive freedom, voting rights, free speech, women's rights, gun rights, and presidential immunity, among other decisions. The ACLU was involved in cases throughout the term, and we're coming out somewhere in the middle this term. Some losses, some wins. We're going to discuss it all. Here to help us reconcile the decisions from this Supreme Court term is returning favorite David Cole, the ACLU's National Legal Director. David, welcome back to At Liberty. It's good to have you again.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, David, this term's stakes were as high as we've seen over the past few years. And as we know, there still remains a 6-3 conservative majority. The ongoing theme of this court is seemingly this question of, is the court becoming more and more purely political? How do you answer that question based on the decisions that we've seen this term?
Well, I'm not sure it's becoming more and more political, but it is certainly becoming more and more aggressive in its exercise of the power of the majority, by which I mean the six justices who are appointed by Republicans, very conservative, and now have a very comfortable majority, but they've used that power to really remake the law in significant areas. In other areas, they're content to be minimalist, content to decide cases in a less partisan divided way, to follow precedent and the like. But, you know, I mean, this term, they made up immunity, criminal immunity for President Trump out of whole cloth, first time in the nation's history that such an immunity has even been suggested.
Yeah. So I want to start with the Trump immunity decision. As you just said, the justices kind of pulled this out of whole cloth. What do you mean by that? Trump versus United States, what was the question before the court, and what do you make again of their decision?
So the question was whether a president is immune from being prosecuted criminally for acts that he takes while president in his official capacity as president. And when I say they made that up out of whole cloth, that's just the truth. I mean, if you look at the Constitution, it provides immunity to legislators, members of Congress, for certain things they do on the floor of Congress. It does not provide immunity to the president. If you look at the intent of the framers, Alexander Hamilton said, absolutely, the president must be accountable to the criminal law. And every president until today, until President Trump, understood that they were subject to criminal prosecution after they left office. In fact, Trump's lawyers in the second impeachment argued that, you know, not impeaching Trump for the January 6th would not leave him above the law because he could be prosecuted. And then when he's not impeached and he is prosecuted, they turn around and argue he has immunity. So it really is, it comes out of nowhere from a court that is supposedly originalist and supposedly tied to the text of the Constitution. This is nowhere supported by originalism, and it essentially places the president above the law.
And what was the reasoning of the justices that decided to grant this kind of immunity?
The reasoning was that if presidents are worried that they might be prosecuted when they leave office, they will not be sufficiently energetic and decisive while in office. The problem with that argument is, as I said before, presidents from George Washington on have understood that they could be held liable criminally if they actually engaged in criminal conduct. And I don't see any evidence that any of those presidents were, you know, meek, timid, afraid to take decisive action because of this fear. That said, going forward, presidents will now know that they don't have to fear criminal liability for anything they do using the power of their office. So just imagine if President Trump, if Donald Trump is elected president again, he's already said he wants to use his office to go after his enemies, to get retribution. This decision basically gives him a blank check, gives him a free pass. Go for it, because even if you're doing it for criminal purposes, corrupt purposes, you cannot be held criminally accountable for doing so.
Yeah. And so essentially now they're saying that Trump or any president is immune from criminal prosecution while doing, in quotes, official activities of the presidency, but not in unofficial acts. They're sending this case back to the lower court to decide what constitutes an official act. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, gave a very concerning readout on the situation. She says, in brief, the president is king above the law. It is very concerning, David. I want to move to a happier moment, if we can. I want to continue our discussion with talking about the two reproductive freedom decisions we received from the Supreme Court this term. I feel like the reproductive rights story is basically from the court who brought you the overturn of Roe. This could have been worse. Technically, we would consider both of these cases the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus the FDA and Moyle versus United States wins, if even only slightly. I want to start with the mifepristone case first. This is Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA. This was in no small part a way to try to ban mifepristone nationwide. What did we hear in those arguments, and what was the ultimate decision?
So I think, first of all, it's fair to say that we essentially dodged bullets in both of the abortion decisions this term, because the court ultimately did not accept arguments by opponents of abortion, but it did so without really resolving the merits of either case. So in the medication abortion case, doctors who opposed abortion had challenged the FDA's approval of medication abortion all the way back to 20 years ago when they first approved it, up to more recent changes that allowed people to get it through telemedicine and from pharmacies and the like, and not having to travel unnecessarily to clinics. And the lower courts ruled that a number of those rules were invalid, arbitrary, and capricious. The case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court unanimously reversed the lower court decisions against the FDA and against access to medication abortion. But they did so on standing grounds. They held that the doctors who brought the suit really couldn't show any actual injury from the medication abortion rules, since they don't provide abortions, and therefore they couldn't bring a challenge to the rules. So the rules remain for now. If somebody does come forward with standing, the question will be raised again. But it's hard to imagine who would actually have standing, so it's quite possible that that's the end of that case.
If we move on to the emergency abortion care case, this one we thought, based on arguments, we could be potentially more likely to lose. And while it wasn't a huge win, it also wasn't a loss. This is the case of Moyle versus United States. Why are we considering this decision only a slight win for now?
So I think it's a draw and at most a slight win, because essentially what the court did was dismiss the case. However, in sending it back, they also lifted a stay that they had put in place against a district court ruling that had preserved emergency room abortions. So as long as that stay was in place, women coming to emergency rooms in Idaho needing an abortion had to be airlifted out of the state. Now that the court has lifted the stay and put back in place the injunction, women who need abortions in an emergency situation can and will get abortions in Idaho, but the case proceeds. They sent it back down, and it's going up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, and the ultimate disposition of the case remains very open-ended. The court had an opportunity to make clear that federal law trumps state law in this situation, and that when somebody comes into an emergency room, and needs an abortion in order to stabilize their situation, that's what the law requires. It requires stabilizing treatment. It doesn't have any exception for abortions. But the court didn't do that. It instead opted not to decide. So, you know, it missed an opportunity, but it could have, you know, been much worse in the sense that it could have taken the case, decided that Idaho law trumped federal law in this instance. That would have been a much worse result.
Well, and thank God we're here for the long game. So the next time one of these things happens, we'll be ready to fight it again. I want to move on to another win, United States versus Rahimi. This was an 8-1 decision, a blowout of sorts. The court voted to uphold a federal criminal law that makes it a felony for anyone subject to a civil domestic violence restraining order to possess a gun. David, can you further explain the court's decision here and also the dissent by Justice Thomas, who was the lone wolf in providing that dissent, and then perhaps the significance that this decision will have for survivors of domestic violence?
Sure. Yeah. So this is a case that, you know, in some sense, they had to decide in the way that they decided it, as President Biden would say. The idea that it is unconstitutional to take a gun away from somebody who is subject to a domestic violence protective order because he poses a direct and imminent threat to his domestic partner is crazy, right? So they had to reach this result. But the question was, how were they going to reach this result? Because a couple of terms ago, you'll remember that the court in a case involving New York's rules limiting the right to carry guns in public to people who actually showed they had a need to do so, the court struck down that century-old law saying the Second Amendment guarantees the right to own and carry a weapon, and the only limits that are permissible are those that have historical analogs from the time that the amendment was adopted. And so the lower court in this case said, well, we look back to when the Second Amendment was adopted, and there were no laws denying guns to people who were under domestic violence protective orders. Well, of course not, because there were no domestic violence protective orders, but that's the test, the historical test that the court had put in place in the Bruin case from a couple of years ago. What they did was they kind of raised the level of generality. And they said, well, there's not, and this is what we argued in our brief in support of the law. We said, you know, there may not be a law that, you know, a direct historical twin, but there are historical precedents for this in the sense that there were laws back, you know, predating the Constitution that took arms away from people who were determined by a judge to be dangerous in one setting or another. And that's a sufficient precedent to, you know, to make this constitutional. And that's ultimately what the court said. I will say that the United States advanced a much more aggressive position, and we opposed this position. They took the position that the Second Amendment right to bear arms only extends to, quote, law-abiding, responsible citizens, unquote. People who violate the law have a right to have their privacy respected, and most of the rights in the Constitution apply to all persons, not to citizens. So we thought the United States position was far too broad, and we urged the court to uphold the law under the narrower theory that we advanced, and that's exactly what they did. So what the result is, it ensures that women who are under the protection of a protective order don't have to worry or have less to worry that their potential abuser will come armed, but it leaves open for another day, for example, whether a categorical prohibition on any ex-felon possessing a gun ever in their life is constitutional or not.
Awesome. Thanks for explaining that to us. This is actually a hard one. I want to talk about Alexander versus South Carolina as NAACP. This is a voting rights case. We were a part of this case with our partners at the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. We lost this case because the court decided that the racially gerrymandered map that South Carolina drew for congressional districts didn't meet the test of racial discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Listeners might recall that we won last year in a case about racial gerrymandering in Alabama. What is the distinction between these two cases, David?
So last year's case called Milligan was a case under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which provides that if you can demonstrate that minority voters have had their votes diluted by districting that, you know, denies them the ability to elect candidates of their choice, you can get a remedy. And there we demonstrated that Alabama had had essentially denied African-American voters the right to elect candidates of their choice in rough proportion to their numbers. And so the lower court found a violation and the Supreme Court upheld that violation. And there are now two districts in Alabama where African-American voters are a majority and have an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. This case from South Carolina was different. It was under the Constitution. And the Supreme Court, about 20 some years ago, said that if a state draws lines for a voting map using race, that's a form of racial discrimination that violates the Equal Protection Clause, unless it's being done in order to ensure that minority voters have a meaningful opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. We demonstrated that in South Carolina, they had to move about 80,000 voters out of one district that was overpopulated into another district that was underpopulated. Would have been pretty simple to do that. That's not what they did. They ultimately ended up moving 200,000 voters. They disproportionately moved Black voters out, Black and Black majority districts out of the district. And they, after all these 200,000 voter shifts, they ended up with a precise percentage of Black voting population, 17%, that they had started with. And they had, and that just happened to be the kind of trigger point at which the Republicans got worried that they weren't going to be able to control the district. If there were more than 17% Black voters, it was not a safe Republican district. If there were 17% or lower, it was a safe Republican district. So lo and behold, the district they came up with was 17%, and they had race numbers on their computers as they were making the changes. And yet at the trial, they came in and said, oh no, we weren't considering race at all. We were just trying to get a Republican tilt. The court that heard the three judge court that heard all the evidence found that was incredible, that they were in fact using race and that violated the Equal Protection Clause. The Supreme Court took up the case and reversed, and in doing so made it much harder for people to succeed in racial gerrymandering cases where, as is almost always the case, race and politics merge. So again, they made new law to reach a result that ultimately made it okay for South Carolina to draw lines on the basis of race, to use race, not to advance the interests of minorities, but to cement the advantage of the Republicans.
Okay. Two voting rights victories last term, one voting rights setback this term. We will continue to probably see these attacks as they... Voting rights are essential to unlocking every other thing we want to see in our country happen. So I want to move to criminal justice. Another notable loss was delivered in the final days of the term. This is in the case of City of Grants Pass versus Johnson. This case marked the most significant legal challenge to the rights of homeless people in decades. Again, a 6-3 decision written by Justice Gorsuch. The Supreme Court ruled that cities enforcing anti-camping bans, even if homeless people have no other place to go, does not violate the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. David, what will this mean for unhoused people across the country?
So this is a not just a wrong decision, but a cruel decision.
It's a cruel decision, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, as Justice Sotomayor says in her dissent, you know, sleeping is a biological necessity, not a crime. But in Grant's Pass, sleeping in public is a crime. And it's a crime even if you are homeless and you have nowhere else to go. And so the challenge in the case, which had been advanced in a number of jurisdictions successfully, is that when someone has nowhere else to go, making it a crime for them to sleep in public is essentially to punish them for being homeless, for the status of being homeless. And that's cruel and unusual. And the case that the challengers relied on was a case from the 1960s that held that a California law that made it a crime to be addicted to narcotics was cruel and unusual because it punished the status of being an addict, not the conduct of using drugs or buying drugs or possessing drugs or what have you. And so, you know, the argument here is, you know, in one sense, sleeping in public is conduct, but in another sense, it is status. The definition of being homeless or unhoused is that you don't have a place to sleep. And what the courts in these cases had held was that, no, you know, if someone really has nowhere else to go, you can't punish them. If there's a shelter and they refuse to go, you can punish them. But if they have nowhere else to go, you can't punish them for being homeless. And the Supreme Court in the Grant's Pass decision reversed that and said, no, you can punish them for being homeless. You know, what will this mean for the unhoused population? It means that more of them will face criminal prosecution for just being without a home. It's hard enough to be without a home, but now you get criminal liability on top of that. It means that, you know, cities can try to prosecute their way out of the problem. I mean, in Grants Pass, they made it a crime because they didn't have enough beds. They didn't want to pay for more beds. And so they sought to drive people out of Grants Pass by making it a crime. And you're likely to see more and more jurisdictions do that to try to drive the homeless population into the next jurisdiction. But that, of course, doesn't solve the problem. It just moves the problem. So very disturbing decision. And they could have easily said, recognized that, in fact, this is a criminalization of status. It's making it a crime to be homeless, and therefore it's cruel and unusual. But no.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a decision that shook a lot of people because it does feel so punitive. I want to move on to perhaps this shining star issue of the Supreme Court, free speech. We had a few cases, free speech cases. Our first case was representing the NRA. What can you tell us about NRA versus Vullo and why we got involved?
I mean, as our listeners know, we generally do not agree with the NRA on almost anything, but we did agree with them that political advocacy organizations should not be targeted for retribution by powerful government officials. And the First Amendment protects against that, just as it would protect Planned Parenthood or the ACLU, for that matter, from being targeted by government officials who don't like us. So that's the same should hold for the NRA. In this case, Governor Cuomo in New York and his chief financial regulator, Maria Vullo, decided to go after the NRA basically for political purposes because they favored gun control and the NRA was opposed to gun control. So they criticized it. That's perfectly fine. But they instead used the power of their office to coerce others to punish the NRA for its political views. And specifically, the chief financial regulator oversees all the banks and insurance companies in New York, and she told them that they should reconsider doing any business with the NRA because it advocates for gun rights and urged them to cut all their ties with the NRA, and even offered to one insurance company that she would overlook many of its insurance infractions if it would just cut its ties to the NRA. And many insurance companies and banks did precisely that. The NRA sued. The district court said that these allegations state a First Amendment violation. The government can't use its power to encourage others to punish an advocacy group for its political views. And it can't do that directly. It can't do it indirectly. The Second Circuit unanimously reversed and ruled that this was just government speech. It didn't violate any First Amendment rights. At that point, the NRA came to us and asked us, would you represent us in the Supreme Court? And we decided we should, because this was an important principle. The fact that we, the ACLU, was willing to stand up and defend them only underscored how important the First Amendment issue is. And we consider it important because, you know, if Cuomo can do this to the NRA in New York, then just think what DeSantis in Florida, you know, would do to trans rights groups. And so we took the case, and the court ultimately unanimously ruled in our favor, with Justice Sotomayor writing a fabulous majority opinion, and everybody agreeing that this kind of conduct violates the First Amendment. So it was a great victory for the ACLU, for the NRA, but for all of us, because no political organization should be subject to this kind of political vendetta.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you just being so thorough with your explanation about why we got involved in this case. You know, we're often representing and navigating organizations and folks that we disagree with. And that's part of the job at the ACLU. And so I think it's always important to kind of take a beat and explain why we continue to do that. Okay, David, there were a number of other very important free speech cases that were a part of this term. We had the Net Choice case that we were a part of. We had Murthy versus Missouri and a couple of others. So could you take us quickly through some of the decisions that we saw come out in favor of free speech?
Yeah, sure. This was a terrible term for the rule of law, a terrible term for, you know, administrative law in particular. But it was a very good term for the First Amendment. In addition to the NRA versus Fulo, when we already talked about, the court on the last day issued a decision in cases challenging a Texas and Florida law that seek to control the content that social media platforms put up on their platforms. And the court said the state cannot control the editorial choices of a social media platform any more than it can control what books a bookseller sells or what articles or op-eds a newspaper publishes. This is a core aspect of free speech. Social media platforms are speakers. And so the court upheld free speech online. Super important case. A couple other cases the court had involved whether government officials, when they use their private websites to do government business, can they block citizens from access to those websites, or are they subject to a First Amendment challenge if they do so? And the court held that they are subject to a First Amendment challenge if they're using those personal websites to do government business that they're authorized to do. And then in another free speech online case, the court took up the question, or at least initially took up the question, of whether the Biden administration violated the First Amendment rights of various COVID deniers and anti-vaxxers who had their posts taken down by Twitter or Facebook while the Biden administration officials were reaching out to Twitter and Facebook and saying, hey, you know, you should know you've got this very dangerous disinformation on your website about COVID or about vaccines. And in some of those instances, Twitter and Facebook looked at the posts and said, no, we don't think they violate any of our rules and we're going to keep them up. And in others, they took them down. And the people whose stuff was taken down said that violated the First Amendment, kind of along the theories that we prevailed on in NRA versus Vulo, that the government officials were coercing the Twitter and Facebook into taking the posts down. But the court ultimately said that the plaintiffs hadn't established a sufficient connection between the government contacts with the websites and their material being taken down to even be able to come into court and sue, because Twitter and Facebook had their own policies against this stuff. And then in still another case involving retaliatory arrests for speech that government officials don't like, the court reversed a Fifth Circuit decision that had immunized essentially the government from liability for arresting a woman for a bogus charge because she was challenging the actions of a city council. So, you know, in all the First Amendment cases, I think this term the court reached the right result, the principled result, and you know, and the First Amendment remains strong to this day. It's one area where even this very conservative court, you know, you can get across the board agreement on many things, as the NRA versus Fulo case illustrates.
It seems that free speech in general is one of those areas that, you know, regardless of political partisanship, people know that it has value and see that value played out very broadly in our daily life. David, I want to talk just very briefly about the Chevron case, which we have alluded to a couple of times. This wasn't necessarily in our purview at the ACLU involving civil rights or civil liberties, but it does seem worth mentioning as we close today. This case was originally decided back in 1984, and essentially the decision required courts to defer to federal agencies' reasonable interpretations of ambiguous statutes underpinning regulations on healthcare, safety, and the environment. This term with another infamous 6-3 split, Chevron, was overturned. David, what is the potential impact of a decision like this? I read somewhere that said there have been 70 Supreme Court decisions relying on Chevron, along with 17,000 others in the lower courts.
Yeah, this is in administrative law, this is the Dobbs of administrative law. It overturns a fundamental decision going back 40 years that has governed administrative law for the entire period. But it basically says is when a statute is ambiguous, and many statutes are, and the court can't figure out the ambiguity, you know, on the face of it, there's no clear answer to which way to interpret it, the court should defer to the agency that Congress delegated the authority to enforce the statute to, if that agency has adopted a reasonable interpretation. And the idea is that, you know, agencies are experts, courts are not. And that has been the rule for, as I said, 40 years. Suddenly, because six justices don't like that rule, it is no longer the rule. Throughout the doctrine of stare decisis, that is, the things that have been decided in the past should be stuck to unless they've been shown to be unworkable or otherwise obsolete. That is not true with Chevron. And they simply overturned it because they had the power to overturn it, just like they overturned Roe in Dobbs because they had the power to do so. But it was a power grab in another sense, because it basically says now courts are going to be the ones that are going to be deciding these highly technical questions, not agencies. And what it does is take power away from agencies, the agencies that protect our environment, ensure that our food and drugs are safe, protect us from fraud and the like in the financial markets. All of those agencies are now much less powerful, and the court is much more powerful. It's not so clear whether it'll be a net gain or loss for civil rights and civil liberties, but it is definitely a net loss for effective government protecting our environment and protecting us.
Oof, so much to break down, but I think we did it effectively. David, you did it. I think that with everything going on in the future upcoming election, people are very nervous, David. We are leaving yet another SCOTUS term with some pretty deep fear in our bones. I know that you're ever the optimist. What can you tell us that may console us right now as we close?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what I can tell you to console you. I mean, I will say this. I mean, in the cases that we filed this term, we won more than we lost. But there were some major, major losses here. And I think what I would say to, you know, as we go into an election year, is the reason all these decisions came down from Dobbs to the Trump immunity case is because Trump was elected the first time around. Because many people stayed home and didn't vote. And as a result, Trump was elected. He got to appoint three new justices. That changed the balance of the court and gave it this very powerful conservative majority that is now rewriting laws across the books in very bad ways. People should remember that when the election comes forward and vote like your rights depend on it. Because the next president will very likely be able to appoint one or more Supreme Court justices. And that could either entrench this turn to the right, or it could restore some balance on the Supreme Court. Very important to get out and vote like your rights depend on it.
I do think perhaps voting is the most clear sign of an optimistic citizen, someone who is hopeful and is taking action in the direction that they want to see the country. So thank you for that important reminder that voting counts and voting matters. And thank you, as always, for all of your work at the ACLU and for joining me today. It's always really fun to talk with you after the term. I very much enjoy it. So thank you so much for your time.
Likewise, great to talk to you, Kendall. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. Until next week, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio. Joy Smythe-McCauley is our intern.